workshop because we believe that error correction fault tolerance will be needed to operate large-scale quantum computers, needed both to prevent decoherence that interacts with the environment and control the cumulative effects of imperfections in unitary gates. And in this talk, I'm going to focus on fault-tolerant processing using quantum error correcting code, since that's the foundation for our belief that quantum computers are scalable. There are a variety of other useful ideas concerning protecting quantum computers from noise, like dynamical decoupling, noiseless subsystems, and topological protection. And I won't be saying very much about these other ideas, even though I recognize they're important, that they're related to the things I'll talk about and can be truthfully combined with things that I'll discuss. I realize a lot of you are experts on fault-tolerant quantum computing, but perhaps not everyone. So I'll begin by discussing the concept of the quantum error correcting code and how we can do fault-tolerant processing of quantum information protected by a code. Explain how we establish the result that quantum computing is scalable. And then I'll talk about some more recent developments, and I'll end with some discussion of open questions. What do we mean by a quantum computer? We can characterize it mathematically by the quantum circuit model, which has these four elements. Our computation takes place in a large Hilbert space, which has a tensor product decomposition into qubits. We can prepare an initial state of a particular product state of the qubits. We can process the information by executing a quantum circuit, applying a sequence of quantum gates, each of which acts on a small number of quantum gates, or of qubits, like one or two. And then we can read out the computer by measuring in a standard basis one or more qubits. That's a model that can be simulated by a randomized classical computer, but we believe that in general that simulation isn't efficient. The quantum model is more powerful than the corresponding classical model. And the goal of fault-tolerant quantum computing is to simulate this ideal quantum circuit model using the imperfect gates that can be executed in actual devices.
John, I have a kind of a dumb question on that. Or not related. Why are 2 and 4 different? In your last slide.
Are 2 and 4 different? Well, they're not necessarily different for you, because you're going to, in many cases, prepare a state by doing the same procedure as you used to read one out. It's important, I think, to characterize the model in a logically complete way to distinguish. So how should we discuss noise in a quantum computer? Any error occurring on n qubits can be characterized by a unitary transformation that acts on the qubits in their environment. And it's useful to expand the action of such an error on the system qubits in terms of a complete basis for operators acting on the n qubits. And it's particularly convenient to choose as an operator basis poly operators, tensor products of poly matrices. This expression is sufficiently general to encompass both unitary errors that occur without any entanglement between the computer and the environment, and also strong decoherence in which mutually orthogonal states of the environment occur accompanying these operators. I'm not making any assumption about these states being normalized or mutually orthogonal. And our goal in quantum error correction is to reverse the effects of the error to recover the initial unknown state. And we can't expect to succeed for arbitrary errors, but we might succeed if the errors are of a restricted type. And in many physical situations, we expect the noise due to interactions with the environment to be reasonably local. That is, we don't expect collective operations acting on many qubits at once. And with that in mind, we can define the weight of a poly operator as the number of qubits on which it acts non-trivially, the number to which x, y, or z is applied instead of the identity. And so we expect in many situations that the operator's high weight appearing in this expansion occur with a correspondingly small amplitude. And then what we'd like to do is apply some unitary transformation using a quantum computer to the data which has been damaged by the noise and some auxiliary system, an ancilla that we control, which reverses the effect of the errors. And if we're able to do that for, let's say, all the poly operators up to a specified weight T, we say that we can correct T errors in the block of computers. In general, when an error occurs, there is entanglement between the qubits in the computer and the environment, and that's the origin of decoherence. We can't undo the entanglement of the environment with something, but what we can do is transform entanglement of the environment with our qubits into entanglement of the environment with our ancilla, which we can then dispose of. So quantum error correction is a kind of refrigeration. Entropy is pumped out of the computer into the auxiliary system, the ancilla, which can then be discarded. Or if we want to reuse the ancilla, we have to erase it, cool it back down to a temperature close to absolute zero. That erasure is a dissipative process, so to do it, we would pay a power bill, and that would be the unavoidable thermodynamic cost of doing quantum error correction. Now, we don't expect to be able to correct all the errors of weight up to T for arbitrary states in an n-qubit Hilbert space. But we might be able to succeed for states that are contained in some suitably chosen code subspace, a protected space. And if that space has dimension 2 to the k, then we'll say that there are k encoded or protected qubits embedded in a block of n-qubits. Now, how should such a code be constructed? Well, it'll work if we choose the code space so that all of the errors that we want to be able to protect against, like all the poly errors up to a weight t, acting on the code space, take it to mutually orthogonal spaces. Then it'll be possible in principle to perform an incomplete orthogonal measurement to diagnose, to find a syndrome that points to that particular error, or a superposition of different errors will be projected to a particular known one. And once we know what the error is, we can apply its inverse and unitary operator in our quantum computer to recover. It might be that we can't perfectly distinguish all of the errors that we want to be able to correct. But if the ones which can't be distinguished act on the code space in the same way, that's good enough. In that case, we say the code is degenerate. Now, I'm not going to talk, I decided I didn't have time to talk about the details of code construction and construction of fault tolerant gadgets. But we have to observe the important point that in order to do the recovery, to find a syndrome which points to a particular error, we have to do that with a noisy quantum computer, and that raises the issue of fault tolerance. How can we protect a quantum computer from noise using a noisy quantum computer? But some of the issues that arise that when we measure the syndrome to diagnose a particular error, our measurement might be wrong. We have to worry about the propagation of errors during the process of syndrome extraction. And let's remember, we want to not just protect quantum information from damage, we want to process it. So we have to find a way of applying a universal set of quantum gates to the protected information without unacceptable propagation of error. And if we intend to do a long computation reliably, we'll have to have codes that can correct against many errors in code block. So I'm not going to talk about fault-tolerant constructions in detail. We should at least understand what the goal is of those constructions. So for that purpose, it's useful to make a distinction between what I'll call a fault, some location in a quantum circuit where the quantum gate doesn't perform exactly the way the ideal gate would, and an error, a qubit in a code block that deviates from the ideal state. So if we have a quantum code that corrects one error, what we mean by that is that if we have an input that has one error and we perform the error correction flawlessly, the error will be corrected and the output block will not have any errors. But for fault tolerance, we want an additional property of our error correction procedure, namely, if the input has no errors and there's a single fault in the error correction circuit, we want that to produce at most one error in the output block. If that's true, and we try to protect quantum information by performing repeated cycles of error correction, then our memory will be successful at storing the protected information as long as there is no successive pair of error corrections that contain two or more faults. If that doesn't happen, then every time there's a fault which can introduce an error, that error will be corrected before it's joined by a second fault, a second error that could cause an encoded failure. Now, we also need gadgets, circuits, that perform gates on the encoded information. So those gates have to have the property that when they're performed flawlessly on a perfect input, they apply a particular gate to the code space. But in addition, they have to have fault tolerance properties. Namely, if the quantum gate is executed without faults and there's one error in its input, then if it's fault tolerant, there will be at most one error in each of its output blocks. And if the input has no error and there is a fault in the gate gadget, then there should be at most one error in each output block. And if that's the case, we can simulate the ideal circuit by performing our gate gadgets and inserting error correction steps in between successive gates. And our simulation will be successful as long as there isn't what I'll call an extended rectangle, shown in red, which consists of the gate gadget plus the error corrections that immediately precede and immediately follow it. If each one of those has only one fault, then our simulation will be successful, because when a fault occurs, it will introduce a single error, which will be corrected by a subsequent round of error correction. Only if two faults occur in an extended rectangle will an error be joined by a second error that can cause an encoded failure. So the conclusion we draw is that if we do a fault tolerant construction based on the code that can correct one error, then the probability of a failure in the simulation will be second order in the fault rate. So if we say faults occur independently in different locations in the circuit with probability epsilon, the probability of failure will be of order epsilon squared, since what's required is two independent failures in one of these extended rectangles. The coefficient is determined by the combinatorics, or counting the number of ways in which two faulty locations in an extended rectangle can cause its failure. The conclusion is, then, if we want to do the simulation to some fixed accuracy, the size of the circuit that we can simulate will be of order 1 over epsilon squared, whereas if we didn't use error correction, the size of the circuit we can simulate reliably would be of order 1 over epsilon. So if epsilon is small enough, we win and we have a more reliable simulation. Of course, in order to perform a long computation reliably, we'll need to suppress the probability of failure further. And one way of doing that, which is particularly easy to analyze theoretically, is to use a recursive simulation. What I've described so far is taking an ideal gate in a circuit and replacing it by what I'll call a rectangle, which consists of the encoded gate gadget followed by error corrections acting on the output block. Well, this one rectangle is just itself a quantum circuit, and so we can imagine making that replacement again. We replace each level zero gate in the one rectangle. By a one rectangle, we obtain the level two rectangle. And if in the two rectangle, we replace each gate by a one rectangle, we obtain the level three rectangle, and so on. The reason for doing this recursive construction is that if the first level of encoding improves the reliability of our simulation, then doing it again can give us even further improvement. And by introducing enough levels to the recursion, we can suppress the probability of an encoded failure as much as we please. To analyze this type of recursive construction, we need a way of coarse-graining computation, performing what a physicist might call a renormalization group transformation, which takes a level k simulation to a level k minus 1 simulation to which the original computation is exactly equivalent, but with a renormalized model of the noise, or a renormalized strength of the noise. To define that kind of coarse-grained procedure formally, we can use a notion that I'll call correctness. What I've told you so far is that if we use a code that corrects one error, then if we have an extended rectangle which has at most one fault, then the rectangle will do what it's supposed to do, act the way we desire on the encoded information. To make that more formal, we can imagine introducing a fictitious ideal decoder which performs error correction on a code block flawlessly and then maps the code block back down to a single qubit. What we need when we say a rectangle is correct, that it does what it's supposed to do, is that if we apply that ideal decoder to the output of the rectangle, the result is the same as if we applied the decoder to the input to the rectangle and then applied the ideal gate to the resulting decoded qubit. And there are similar notions of correctness for measurements of encoded blocks and for preparations of encoded blocks. So if I have a level one circuit, say, and I want to describe it in terms of an equivalent level zero circuit, what I can do is materialize decoders in front of the measurements at the end of the circuit. And in the case of a good measurement, which contains no more than one fault, in doing so, we'll transform the measurement of a block into an ideal measurement to be cubic. And then we can take the decoders in one step at a time, move them forward in the circuit, hopping over the rectangles one at a time, and thereby transforming any good rectangle that contains no more than one fault to the corresponding ideal gate. And when the decoders get to the front of the circuit, where they meet preparations of encoded blocks, they disappear and they transform good preparations to ideal preparations of qubits. So that's our procedure for reducing the circuit to one at a lower level. We can apply it to a level k circuit and get a level k minus one circuit. This will modify the noise model. And if we can characterize the way the noise model changes in a simple way, and if the noise model has some nice stability properties under this coarse graining or level reduction, then we can repeat it many times and get a reduction of a level k simulation to a circuit with, one hopes, a very small noise rate. So what kind of noise models will this type of procedure apply to? One that we can analyze we call local stochastic noise. What I mean by stochastic noise is that we can express the noisy circuit as a sum over fault paths, each of which is weighted by a probability. Where in a fault path, there are specified locations, specified gates in the circuit, which are faulty, and the rest are assumed to be ideal. The defining property of local stochastic noise with strength epsilon is that if I sum the probabilities of all the fault paths that have faults at our specified locations in the circuit, that can that probability can be bounded above by epsilon raised to the power r. So if that's true and we apply our level reduction procedure, local stochastic noise gets mapped to local stochastic noise, but with a new strength. And in fact, the renormalized strength will be of order epsilon squared, because in order to have our faulty level one locations, we would have to have two faulty level zero gates in each of our rectangles. And the quantity epsilon naught that appears here arises from combinatorial considerations, essentially from counting the number of malignant pairs of locations in a one rectangle, the number of ways in which two faults can cause an encoded failure. If we repeat the procedure k times, then we get a renormalized strength of the noise, which dives very steeply as the level k increases, double exponentially in k. So with a relatively modest number of levels, we can get an effective strength of the noise, which is very weak as long as epsilon is less than this value epsilon naught. So that leads to the quantum accuracy threshold theorem, which says that if we want to simulate an ideal circuit to some fixed accuracy, and let's say the noise can be described by local stochastic noise with strength epsilon, then as long as epsilon is less than a critical value, we can do that simulation at some overhead cost. But the overhead cost is relatively modest because of that very steep reduction in the effective noise as the level increases. It's a factor that blows up the size of the circuit, which is a power of a logarithm of the size of the circuit to be simulated. So that result was known over 10 years ago. And what has happened somewhat more recently is we've recognized that we can prove this kind of theorem to recursive hierarchies that are built from codes that can correct one error. And that's allowed us to get rigorous bounds on the threshold that are better than those that could be obtained previously. And the result we obtained a couple of years ago was a lower bound on the threshold of 2.7 times 10 to the minus 5. To prove such a threshold theorem, various assumptions are needed, and the most important ones are that we can operate gates in parallel, so we can control noise in our quantum computer, different parts of the computer simultaneously. And we have a continuous supply of fresh and so let's flush out the entropy introduced by the noise. To get this specific number, further assumptions were made. We ignored geometry and supposed, rather unrealistically, that we can perform a gate on any pair of qubits, no matter where they're located in our device. And we assume that it's possible to make measurements as quickly as we can execute quantum gates. That's where the subject stood about 2 years ago. Now some of the things I want to mention are developments.
John?
Yeah?
Before you go on, just taking a step back about parallelism. Mm-hmm. Is the parallelism you describe the really necessary, or is there a restricted form here? In the sense that you're doing a very specific repetitive thing in each circuit, so is there some sort of subset of parallelism necessary, or is it like arbitrary?
Some subset of parallelism. The important thing conceptually is that we might have a circuit which has high width, so there are many qubits, and so we have to simulate that circuit by including many encoded blocks, and we need to be able to control the errors in each one of those blocks at the same time. That's the origin of the need for parallelism. So the first development I want to discuss is an improvement in lower bounds on the threshold using the concept of subsystem codes. A subsystem code means a decomposition of a Hilbert space of, let's say, 10 qubits into a direct sum of spaces, each of which is labeled by a syndrome, where each space is decomposed as a tensor product of a logical system, which is where our protected information resides, and a gauge system that we don't really care about. We can always take such a subsystem code and obtain from it a standard conventional quantum code by fixing the gauge, by fixing the state of these gauge qubits. But it's not necessary to fix the gauge. And sometimes it's convenient to maintain the gauge free. For one thing, that reduces the number of check operators that we have to measure, the additional ones that we're not measuring. We just keep track of the noise in the gauge subsystem, and we don't care about that. Also, the syndrome information, which allows us to identify the nature of an error, can be extracted just by measuring the gauge qubits, and for some codes, the gauge qubit operators have lower weight and are simpler to realize than the check operators, which diagnose the errors. So it's easier to measure the gauge operators both time. So this is an example of a subsystem code. I call it the Bacon Shore code because really it's the first quantum code that Peter Shore wrote down 12 years ago, and Dave Bacon pointed out that it can be usefully regarded as a subsystem code. To characterize the code, it's convenient to imagine it's a 9-qubit code. The qubits arranged in a 3x3 square array. And the check operators that diagnose the errors are weight 6 operators, which apply x to all the qubits in 2 rows, or apply z to all the qubits in 2 columns. The logical operations, Pauli operators acting on the one-dimensional code space, can be taken to be x's acting on all the qubits in a row, or z's acting on all the qubits in a column. Now, the gauge system consists of Pauli operators that commute with the logical operators and the check operators. And we can choose those to be weight 2. If I consider a product of z's acting on 2 qubits in the same row, that will commute with the logical x and with these x-type check operators. And if I consider a product of 2 x's acting on qubits that are in the same column, that will commute with the logical z and the z-type check operators. The gauge operators don't commute with each other, but they do commute with the logical operators and the check operators. But furthermore, if I measure eigenvalues of all the gauge qubit operators, that determines values of the check operators. For example, if I measure z on a product of neighboring qubits in the same row, that times this product of z's and this product of z's is one of the z-type check operators, and similarly for the x-type check operators. As a result, because we only have to measure weight 2 operators to extract the syndrome information, it's simpler than you might naively think, since the check operators have weight 6. Pauli, Ferris, and Cross use this type of coding scheme to analyze the threshold, essentially to count the number of malignant locations in the rectangles for such a coding scheme. And actually, they got the best numerical results for the case of a 5x5 code for two errors. And they were able to boost the lower bound on the threshold from their type of analysis to 1.9 times 10 to the minus 4. The second development I want to mention is taking the geometry into account and estimating the threshold for the case in which only local gates are allowed. This was done by Soria, Dimitri, Tenzel, and Chacal. They considered a scheme in which, in two dimensions, we can only perform gates on neighboring qubits in a square array. In their scheme, each qubit is associated with a 6x8 cell in this square array. That cell contains 7 qubits in a code block for a code that can corrupt one error, which are denoted D1 through 7. There's also an ancilla block, which is used for extracting the syndrome, qubits in green A1 through A7. And 3 more qubits that are used to verify the ancilla before it's permitted to come in touch with the data. And all the other qubits in the cell, denoted 0, are dummy qubits, which aren't used in the computation. But the reason they're there is that we have to perform swap gates in order to bring the qubits that we want to interact into contact with one another. And it would be dangerous to perform a swap on 2 qubits that we care about, because a faulty swap then could damage 2 of the qubits that we care about. It's much safer to swap a qubit that we care about with dummy qubits, and then if it's faulty, it only damages the dummy qubit, which we don't care about, and the qubit we care about. So the dummy qubits are there to give us channels for swapping qubits around, so they can be brought in contact with one another when needed. And one of the gates that we'll have to build level by level in our recursive hierarchy will be a swap gate. So there will be a level 1 swap gate, level 2, and so on. So I borrowed from Krista's story just to show you what it's like. A picture. Yeah, I had the problem the last time I gave this talk, but whenever I do it at home, I don't have any problems.
Sorry.
Why click on the sidebar and then.
Well, click where it says 62. Click on the 62. Type 1.
Okay, I can't type in that window.
And what you mean, I'll start to the sidebar and shift it all to the first page? To the you can't do that.
Over here, you mean?
No, no, right. Just, you know.
Oh, just slide it up, you think?
Yeah.
Hey, see, I don't think I'm going to be able to grab it.
Oh, you can't access it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Someday I'll figure out why I have this problem.
There it is.
Well, you know, I may for some reason have to close the. Well, you know what? I'm just going to tell you that if this had been my lucky day, I would have shown you, just because it's kind of interesting, the extended rectangle for the CNOT gate, which includes error corrections done in parallel on 2 blocks. There are 2 neighboring cells here, and what we need to do with CNOT gate, which involves encoding the ancilla and corresponding the ancilla, letting the ancilla come in contact with the data. Then we have to start swapping and bring the 2 data blocks in contact with one another so we can do the logical control not gate. And then we start swapping the data qubits back, meanwhile preparing the ancilla. And in their construction, it takes altogether 61 time steps to realize the control not extended rectangle. And then one can analyze that by hand. Weird.
Closing the PDF.
Try closing it. Yeah. But it has something to do with when I put it in on the external display, I guess. I don't know. So by counting the number of pairs of malignant locations, they were able to estimate the threshold. And the important thing about their conclusion is they found that taking the geometry into account, allowing only local gates in 2 dimensions, doesn't have a dramatic effect on the threshold. They reduced it by something like a factor of 2. Well, the third development I want to mention is showing that fault tolerance works, even if we can't do fast measurements for the threshold results I've described so far. We assume that we can make a measurement as fast as we can perform the gate, which might not be a good assumption for some implementations of quantum computing. It seems that fast measurements are useful because we make the measurements to extract syndrome information so that we can recover, and we want that information, or so it would seem, in a timely manner. We also use measurements to sometimes verify ancillas, which are rejected when the verification fails, so we need, it seems, to get the measurement results quickly to know whether to accept or reject an ancilla. But DiVincenzo and Alan Ferris pointed out that the fast measurements are not really needed. If we imprint the syndrome information on an ancilla, which we then read out, it's not essential to read out the ancilla right away. Even if there's a delay in the readout, we eventually find out what the syndrome was. And that means we can make an inference about when logical errors occurred in our circuit. And by an efficient classical computation, those errors can be propagated through the circuit so that we know how to interpret the final results. And when we prepare an ancilla and we want to check it, rather than measuring the ancilla and then deciding to throw the, rather than verifying the ancilla and then deciding to throw the ancilla away or keep it, what we can do is decode the ancilla and determine later on whether the ancilla was faulty. And then when it came in contact with data, we can infer what kind of logical error occurred, which can again be propagated through the circuit. So their important conclusion was that even if measurements take something like 1,000 times longer than gates, the threshold is not very much affected.
If you need more ancilla.
Do you need more ancilla? Right, you need, that's right. So because there may be 1,000 of them waiting to be measured, there is a requirement that we have additional qubits, so there's a there's no way. And the next development concerns inferring an accuracy threshold which is further improves the lower bound, making use of error detection. I've explained how using a Bacon Shor code, a la Ferris Frost, we can get a lower bound on the accuracy threshold of about 1.9 times 10 to the minus 4. We'd be able to further improve the threshold if we had a way of using gates that are noisier than this noise string to simulate gates which have a lower fault rate. Pinnell had an idea for doing that. She proposed a couple of years ago, and the recent development is that we've seen how to put Pinnell's ideas on a rigorous basis. His idea starts with the observation that we can teleport quantum gates. That is, we can prepare a suitable encoded, entangled ancilla, and then do a joint measurement on one of the blocks of the ancilla and incoming data to prepare the other block of the ancilla as the result of applying a particular gate, depending on how this ancilla is prepared, to the input, up to some poly operators that are known from the measurement and propagated through the circuit. And this construction is pretty robust with respect to errors in the ancilla. It can still work reliably if the error rate in the ancilla is, say, something like 5%. If the errors in the ancilla can be regarded as essentially independent, if they have negligible correlations. But the trouble is that when we prepare an encoded ancilla, the encoding circuits typically propagate errors back. So what Pinnell suggested is that we can use an error detecting code to check for errors in the ancilla preparation, doing an error detection step after every gate in the encoding circuit, and accept the ancilla only if no errors are detected at any step. And then, if no errors are detected and we accept, we can decode the error detecting code. Errors might occur during that decoding process, but they will be independent errors because the qubits are out of contact during that decoding. So to see if this scheme works, we have to analyze a post-selected circuit, one in which the computation is accepted only if no errors are detected. So I've explained how if we use an error that corrupts one code, the simulation will be successful as long as we don't have two faults in one extended rectangle. There's a similar statement that can be made about a code that detects one error, that identifies that an error has occurred when there is one, but doesn't tell us what recovery step is needed to reverse the error. That is, if we have no more than one fault in each extended rectangle, and we're using a code that can detect one error, then the error introduced by the fault will be detected. We will have an encoded failure only if two faults occur in some extended rectangle, allowing a second error to accompany the first, making an encoded operation. So that means that conditioned on acceptance, we can reduce the probability of failure to order epsilon squared. And we can hope to recursively further reduce the probability of failure. However, there's a subtlety that arises. Because we're doing a post-selected computation in which we accept the computation only in the event that no errors are detected anywhere. As a result, the post-selected computation cannot tolerate correlations in the noise which would be acceptable if we were using error correction instead. Suppose we're interested in the probability that some particular gadget in our circuit fails. Well, we're interested in the probability of failure conditioned on global acceptance. And if we allow an adversary to decide what the operations are at faulty locations elsewhere in the circuit, that adversary could choose to enhance the probability of acceptance of the circuit in the case where the fault that he likes occurred in this part of the circuit, or to suppress the probability of acceptance if the faults that he desires don't occur in that part of the circuit. So the probability of failure conditioned on global acceptance could be much different than the probability of failure conditioned on local acceptance just in this part of the circuit itself. So what that means is, if we're going to successfully prove the threshold theorem for post-selected quantum computation, we have to choose the right kind of noise model. We'd like to have a noise model that limits this type of global power of the adversary to greatly boost conditional probabilities, but is also stable under level reduction. So we can perform level reduction steps many times to get a very small effective value of noise. So the type of noise model for which we found this to be done, we call locally correlated stochastic noise. Here, there are local adversaries at each circuit location who, when the gates are faulty, can decide the nature of the fault. But the communication among the adversaries is limited. They communicate locally by sending messages through the circuit. And those messages are erased every time a message passes through an ideal gate. So in that case, if the noise is weak, it means that the clusters of faults in the circuit for which collective operations are possible because there's communication among the faults are typically small and widely separated from one another. And the different clusters are uncorrelated. So that means that the probability of failure conditioning on local acceptance is not very much different from conditioning just on, or did I say it wrong? Conditioning on global acceptance isn't much worse than conditioning on local acceptance. And we're able to get a lower bound on the threshold, slightly above 10 to the minus 3 using this scheme. There's a substantial overhead cost for this type of error detection routine because most of the ancillas that we try to prepare get rejected. Formally, that cost is just constant, independent of the size of the circuit being simulated, but it can be a prohibitively large constant when the fault rate is close to this threshold value. Nevertheless, it seems there's a intermediate range of the noise string for which combining error detection and error correction ideas can make fault tolerance more effective. And the last thing I wanted to highlight is something we'll hear about at this meeting, so I won't say much about it. I haven't said much about any of these things, actually. This is a different way of estimating the threshold for local gates by Rosendorf et al., which uses rather different ideas than what I've described so far. It's not based on recursive constructions, but on cluster states and topological codes. In their construction, one has a topologically protected control NOT gate, and that combined with the ability to robustly measure the logical CNS poly operators, and also the ability to distill certain additional states can boost the scheme to one capable of doing universal quantum computations. Their CNOT gate really arises from the Aharonov-Bohm interaction between magnetic and electric excitations in a certain Abelian anion model. So they really have two different ways of encoding quantum information, an electric encoding and a magnetic encoding. And they describe how you can transform one encoding into the other so that you can perform CNOT gate just on qubits that are encoded, say, using the magnetic scheme. And they estimate that their CNOT gate is robust against depolarizing noise with a fault rate slightly below 1%. And furthermore, they argue that at that fault rate, they can do the state displacement successfully and boost to universal quantum computing fault tolerance. The analysis, though it's not fully rigorous, is very suggestive, and I think it could be usefully generalized and formalized. Okay, so now the last few things I wanted to mention are questions. The first is, to what extent can we extend results that were obtained a couple of years ago concerning fault tolerance against non-Markovian noise? From a physicist's perspective, it's natural to describe noise in a Hamiltonian model, where the Hamiltonian is an ideal part which would execute the quantum computation perfectly, some Hamiltonian for the environment, and then a perturbation that describes the noise, which includes a coupling between the system and the bath or environment. For fault tolerance to work, we want the noise to have nice locality properties. And what that means here is that this perturbation should be local acting on the system, a sum of terms, each of which acts on just a few system qubits, like one or two. Now we can write the unitary operator that describes the evolution of the system and the bath as a coherent sum over fault paths, where in each fault path, some of the gates are faulty and others are ideal. And from this Hamiltonian model, we can infer that the noise can be described as local noise with a strength epsilon. That means if we sum up all the fault paths such that R specified locations in the circuit are faulty, the operator norm of that sum is epsilon raised to the power R, or is no larger than that. But this quantity epsilon can be expressed this way. T0 is the time we need to execute a gate, and it arises because we can insert the perturbation that makes the gate faulty at any time of this range. And then the cost of inserting the perturbation can be estimated or bounded by the maximum operator norm of the terms in the system that can alternate. And so now, again, we can analyze a recursive simulation. And in effect, if we look at a level K simulation, we can get a bound on the operator norm of the sum of all the diagrams in which the fault path is bad and can cause an encoded failure, and show again that if this parameter epsilon is small enough, that norm becomes double exponentially small, and we can derive a threshold theorem. Our threshold condition, as I said, is expressed in terms of a condition on the operator norm of the system bad coupling. But expressing the threshold condition in that form has disadvantages. For one thing, this operator norm is not something that the experimentalist can directly access in studies of a real device. And furthermore, if, as it's often convenient to do, we model the noise by coupling the system to a bath of harmonic oscillators, that operator norm is formally infinite, and so we don't learn anything useful from this condition. It would be preferable and more broadly applicable that we could express the threshold condition in a different way in terms of correlation functions of the bath, for example. The problem with the operator norm condition is it's placing too strong a constraint on the very high frequency fluctuations of the bath. Intuitively, those very high frequency fluctuations should average out over a time scale comparable to the time it takes to execute the gate. So it would be better if we could formulate our threshold condition in terms of some effective description of the noise in which the very high frequencies have been integrated out and taken into account in some effective way. And I don't know at present how to obtain a rigorous result that has that flavor. The second question I wanted to mention is whether we can take advantage of asymmetries in the noise that occur in many physical settings to obtain better realizations of both tones. There are a lot of physical settings where dephasing is much stronger than relaxation. Z errors are more common than X errors. And that arises because dephasing can be driven by low frequency noise, whereas relaxation arises from noise which has a frequency comparable to the energy splitting between two basis states that are cubic. So it would be nice to get an improved accuracy threshold that applies to this type of asymmetric situation. We can certainly use quantum error correcting codes that correct more Z errors and X errors. We could use, for example, a Bacon-Shiller type scheme where it's based on a rectangular array, so there's more error correcting power to Z errors than the X errors. But there's more to the story than that, because we have to devise a universal set of gate gadgets that don't harmfully propagate errors, don't in particular turn Z-type errors into X-type errors, the type that we have a lot of error-correcting power for to the type that we don't. And it's possible, at least mathematically, to construct a set of universal fault-tolerant gates, which are nice from the point of view of this type of error propagation. CNOT gates, for example, won't propagate Z-errors to X-errors. And one can do an estimate of the threshold for this type of asymmetric situation. I don't think it's ever been done carefully, and it would be instructive to do it more carefully. But it's not quite sure physically what the result means. It has to be interpreted with caution, because we should always have in mind that gates are realized by a Hamiltonian, which turns on and turns off. And in principle, a Z error that occurs while a qubit is rotating on the Bloch sphere will induce an X error. We know that such effects can be suppressed by using composite pulse sequences if we can generate pulses that are fast compared to the coherence time of the bath. But my question is, if we don't use such techniques, is it possible to have a fault-tolerant scheme for this type of asymmetric situation? The idea would be to have gates that are realized by a time-dependent Hamiltonian that commutes with Z and won't propagate Z errors badly, but which we boost to a universal set through teleportation methods. It's possible in principle to do universal computation with just measurement in the X basis and interactions that can be generated by Hamiltonian that's diagonal in the Z basis. But it's not so obvious how we make that fault tolerant. For example, a controlled Z gate can be realized with a time-dependent Hamiltonian that doesn't propagate Z to X, but it's not clear how to make it transversal, easily fault tolerant in the case of asymmetric code. And I guess I'm really over time, so, but Michael has been very polite. So I'll just, so I won't talk about my last question, I guess. It has a rather different flavor. And it has to do, it's a question that Dave Bacon has consistently asked, in fact, whether we can topologically protect quantum information in an intrinsically stable way at finite temperature. And there it is. Whether we can, in three dimensions, protect quantum information in a way which is stable against thermal effects without having to do with active error correction. We know in principle we can do that in four dimensions, but it's not known whether it's possible in three, and it would be nice to know. So, as I've indicated, there have been interesting advances in our understanding of fault tolerance in the last couple of years, and I think as the subject advances, we grow more confident that we can use these ideas to realize scalable quantum computers, and I hope this workshop will contribute to further advances in the field. Thank you.
Threshold theorems are proven case by case, first for simplistic local noise models and then for correlated long-range noise, sufficiently fast decaying coherent noise. Do you see possibility of proving a threshold theorem of following form. Suppose our noise model satisfies this condition, then we can prove fault tolerance. So that the threshold theorem does no longer need to be proven case by case.
Well, I foresee the possibility of doing that, and that was kind of my first question when I was saying, let's use some characterization of the noise, which is something that an experimentalist could check, and let's show that with that characterization there is a threshold theorem. And I think the results that we have now don't quite have that feature, but it should be possible.
So, one thing that you only mentioned briefly is, of course, when one does compaction, the size of your neural space is growing.
Right.
So you're suppressing errors, double expansion.
Right.
On the other hand, there is some knowledge that there is quantum growth, the distance growing as the number of qubits evolve. And so one can ask, could we do better in terms of practical implementation if we were to focus on larger and larger qubits rather than
Well, it's something that actually Andrew Steen has written about, and he's considered codes with larger block size in order to do informal and numerical estimates of the threshold and the overhead cost, which are more favorable in terms of overhead costs than the type of scheme I discussed. You know, the topological coding scheme has kind of a, in principle, scaling. There are a lot of issues in doing the complete set of universal gates, which involves some state distillation, which has some overhead costs that we have to analyze.
Can I say something about that? Actually, Andrew Cross will give a talk about a study that we did in which we looked at the overhead. But this overhead question is different at different levels of computation. So for example, at the bottom level, you say, well, I don't care, I allow some sizable overhead because I want to get a good threshold. I'm really shooting for getting, you know, dealing with the noise that I actually have in my physical system. At the next level, you say, well, now I'm, say, a lower noise rate. Now I can start picking codes, or at least at the top level, I can start picking codes that are block codes, for which maybe the threshold's not optimal, but they're very good in terms of the overhead. So the way we look at it is it's sort of if you look at an arbitrary level by level, what is the optimal pick for your code? So we did a study at the bottom, these sort of bottom codes. What would be a good code to have fairly, not so much overhead, but to improve
the
Wrap up there, and that's all. Thank you again.